Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, online training for new and experienced product managers, where I turn product managers into product masters. I have something really exciting to share. I've created the Product Mastery Roadmap that guides product managers to become product masters, doubling and more your product success rate and creating products customers love and want without being overwhelmed as a product manager. Download the free Product Mastery Roadmap at theeverydayinnovator.com. The discussion today with my guest is about selecting ideas to be developed into product. Many organizations encourage employees, partners, customers, and other stakeholders to provide those ideas for products, but only a few companies successfully manage organizing ideas, selecting the best one, and executing well to turn ideas into valuable products. Peter Duggan, a senior vice president and head of product management and development for Computershare Investor Services, has created a simple and effective five-step process for selecting the best ideas for new products. He shared some of these concepts in a workshop at the Product Innovation Management Annual Conference, and I'm delighted to have him share the five steps with us. After listening, you'll know how to help your organization become idea-selecting ninjas through a few simple steps. To get the notes of the discussion, go to theeverydayinnovator.com/054. Hi, Peter. Thanks for sharing your experiences with idea selection and telling the Everyday Innovators how this is going to work.
Sure, my chat.
So before we can actually go about selecting product ideas, we have to first have those ideas. So let's start there, provide a little foundation. How are ideas generated in your organization?
I guess I'll start by saying how they're not generated, which is we don't run campaigns with catchy names that imply that idea generation is something you just do every once in a while for a short time period. Mm-hmm. We like to solicit ideas on a regular basis from managers, team leaders, people who are close to the front lines and have staff that can come up with those ideas, and just do it as part of team meetings. I can either myself or one of my product managers will sit in on team meetings and solicit questions, or we'll ask the managers themselves at their meetings to come up with ideas and submit them back to us. Okay. And we always say no idea is a bad idea, so we're all about getting the more the better.
But in reality, we do know that there are maybe no ideas or bad ideas, but there are ideas we don't want to take action on. And we definitely want to select those that are most important, but it's kind of hard to get our hands around what is most important some of the time. So why is it important to select, you know, those best product ideas? And I'm not even sure, you know, what best product means some of the time. So can you talk to that about the importance issue, about why we care about this so much?
Sure. Every company is faced with limitations on time and resources. And if you had unlimited resources, you'd do every project that produces positive EBITDA. But given limited resources, both resources of my own staff or whether it's technology, legal, all of the people that would have to be part of various projects and initiatives, you just have to be smart about which ones you literally have the bandwidth to get done. I did say, though, before, when no idea is a bad idea, you're right. Sometimes there are some you don't want to take action on. What I found is important, though, is making sure that the people submitting the ideas feel that every idea is a good idea, and at least you're going to take it seriously and catalog it and look into it. This is the last thing you want to do is sort of put off people from then submitting ideas in the future. Mm-hmm. So we always take them. We take them happily. We may not pursue them for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of, you know, not every idea can be, not every organization has the bandwidth, but we do make sure that the individuals submitting them feel open to submitting any idea.
Absolutely. And I've seen this go badly in too many organizations. And one of the reasons is what you highlighted, is that people are encouraged to share ideas, especially the people that are close to customers. We want to make sure that we're listening to our customers and getting those ideas in. But then there's no good process in place for dealing with the ideas. And over time, people feel like, okay, so you asked me to do this, but you're not doing anything with it. So why am I bothering? I'm actually kind of feeling frustrated.
Right, exactly.
So we need a good process to actually deal with the ideas and select those that make sense for the organization. And this isn't necessarily just the good ideas. It's the ones that are best for the organization, right? Because there might be wonderful ideas, but they're just right for another organization, not what we're after.
Yeah, and depending on your organization, you know, we always say when an idea is submitted, we'd like the person to tell us what is the purpose of the idea. Will it generate additional revenue? Will it save expense? Will it improve client satisfaction? Mm-hmm. So we ask for some sense of what the primary objective of the idea is. And so as part of soliciting the ideas and selecting the ideas, you want to have a balanced portfolio of projects across all those different category types. But not everyone has to produce the million-dollar idea. It's really the sum of many ideas.
And I know when we were first talking about doing this interview, you went through like five elements of that selection process and then putting the ideas into use. And I think that will really help listeners have a good framework for how they could think about selecting ideas in their organization. So let's start with the first one.
Sure. First one is cataloging the ideas. I'll take you through all of them if you like, and then we can talk about them individually. But the second one is sizing those ideas, because not every idea is equal. Then you have to prioritize. And as I mentioned before, you know, depending on whether or not the idea involves the need for technology or legal or operations, you know, you need to be smart about making sure that as you prioritize, you're not overburdening one part of the organization or another, and then you have a balanced portfolio of projects that you've prioritized. Mm-hmm. Then you have to select the ones to do. And then finally, the fifth one, probably the most important, is, you know, managing the project, getting it done.
Okay. Let's dive into cataloging. So we have ideas that have been submitted by employees, other stakeholders, maybe directly customers, suppliers. What's involved in cataloging that idea?
So we put every idea into a fairly simple Excel spreadsheet. Don't need fancy software. It's great if, you know, I know there are packages out there. But we put everything in. We assign it a number.
Always good to keep it simple. Love it. Love
yeah, that. We catalog it with a number, so it's unique. Put in a description of what it is. And we have a template that we ask those that are submitting ideas to complete. Not very complicated. It's a probably two-page template. And we ask, you know, what type of a category, what type of a project is it? Is it, as I said before, revenue, expense, satisfaction? Roughly, we ask the person who's submitting it, do you have any sense of, you know, what it could be worth? Although often they don't, and that's fine. But, you know, we ask them to submit this information. It goes into the catalog, and that allows us to give feedback back to the submitters when we actually begin the projects, if we begin the projects, or even if we decide we're not going to do the projects, we let them know why, so there's some closure for the individual.
Okay. And I'm curious about the scale that you're just working with, so that you have the ideas being cataloged in Excel, keeping track of that. What kind of scale of ideas are you dealing with? Is this, you know, tens, hundreds, thousands?
Right now, we have about 125 ideas in there. Mm-hmm. We do put them in stages, you know, after you've, and we'll talk about the prioritization process. But I look at that pipeline, that list of ideas, in the same way if you're in a sales organization and you've got leads out in the market of new clients, right? That pipeline, that list or catalog is your available target audience of people that you can mm-hmm. sell to if you were a salesperson. And then once they get selected, it's like a lead that you're following, or you're vetting it. It's a lead. Eventually, it moves to the stage where if you actually undertake it as a project, right, then it's a mandate. It's a one piece of business. And finally, when your project's fully implemented, it's closed. And like a piece of new business that you've won, and it's closed and it's producing revenue. So that catalog is your universe. And as I said, it's about 150. It grows and shrinks. But that's where it's been for probably the last couple of years, in the 100 to 200 range.
Yeah, and this is the perspective on innovation, that innovation is a numbers game. Rowan Gibson did a good job of addressing this in his book, Innovation to the Core, that talks about, you know, to be innovative, we just need lots of ideas. Start with lots of them, and then have a process to get down to the ideas we'll really take action on that will end up creating enormous value for our customers. And there's other perspectives, but certainly lots of ideas is a important place to is an important perspective to consider too. So let's dive in more to, now we have them cataloged using our spreadsheet. Is the next thing then the sizing?
Yes, that's right. So I had mentioned before that sometimes we ask the individual who submitted to size it, but depending on who that submitter is, they may not have the skills, the experience to do that. So often one of our product managers who is experienced in whatever the discipline is of the idea. And this is the back of the envelope type of sizing. We're not asking for perfection. We're really asking for someone to note all the assumptions that they make. You know, if it's a matter of a revenue idea, for example, how many specific instances of the opportunity are out there and at what price and, you know, what's the available population. So whatever those assumptions are, we ask the person who's going to be sizing to note the assumptions, including what would you charge for it? You know, what's your, and what's that based on? Why did you come up with that figure? And then the timing, you know, how big a project would this be? Is this something that you think we could roll it out in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? You know, what's your gut tell you on how big and complex this project is and how long it would take? And lastly, what other stakeholders would need to be involved? Because the more complex the project, the more individuals that need to be involved or disciplines that need to be involved. That's all the kinds of things you're going to need later when you're making the decision on selection.
Okay, so the core metrics there is revenue. So how much value are we producing in this product to customers that we might get back in terms of revenue? The timing, does the timing helps us get to kind of figuring out the level of effort, what's involved in this?
Exactly.
Do you look at that also in timing, or do you just say, you know, given our typical team size, we think this project is about 6 months, or you get down to thinking about what is the team size for this project?
Both. So we think about the team size. We think about, you know, from experience on past projects, what would a project of this size, you know, if it's going to be a technical build, knowing the history of previous builds and the kinds of things in the system that are going to have to change, is this a 6 month, a year long project? So, you know, depending on who those other interested parties are, if it's going to involve having to change an operational procedure, how long does that generally take to get changed, procedures updated, people trained? And we're looking for that back of the envelope. Are we talking 3 months, 6 months, a year? One of the things I know I spend a lot of time doing internally is when you look at this 150 database and each one of them has a vetted idea, and, you know, managers will say to me, well, if I just gave you more resources, couldn't you do more of these projects and produce all these great, you know, vetted revenue or expense save? And I say, now it really comes down to what's the capability of the organization to do this much change all at one time. So the reason we want to know all about the project and these assumptions is that ability to say, can only get so much done. So if two of the projects are involving operating change, two are involving technology, you know, two don't involve anyone else but the product team doing something, you know, you sort of look at how do I maximize the number of projects to not be drawing down on any, you know, too strongly on any one discipline.
Right. And does that tie into the stakeholders? I was going to ask you to just talk about the stakeholders aspect of sizing a little bit more, because I could see stakeholders going in two different directions, right? If there is a minimum number of stakeholders involved, there's less inertia involved and a greater potential for velocity through the project, so we can get things done more quickly. At the same time, if there's more stakeholders involved, even though that might increase the inertia, decrease our velocity, it does increase the critical mass and the excitement around getting this project done. So how do you use the stakeholders when you're sizing?
Yeah, so this is where it goes from science to art, right? Up until now, collecting data, putting it into a spreadsheet, some back of the envelope calculations of revenue and assumptions is all very science-y, mathy. The minute you start saying, now, how's the organization going to be able to absorb this, and how many stakeholders are there, and how hard is it going to be to get them to agree to whatever this idea is? Because the group that submitted it, for example, you know, maybe in sales, but the group it's going to affect is in operations. And depending on what else operations has going on, what's going to be their tolerance for wanting to get on board and seeing the value of this project? So that's where it becomes a little more difficult. I mean, you really do need to understand. And we will meet with, you know, once we determine in this initial vetting who the stakeholders are, you know, as part of the prioritization process, which is kind of the next one, you know, we meet with those stakeholders and kind of get a sense of, you know, we think this is a project that's bigger than a breadbasket, but, you know, what do you think? Do you have the bandwidth to help us on this? Because you're going to need in operations to, you know, have some technical experts involved. What else do you have going on? So, yeah, stakeholder management is pretty tricky, and therefore you need to have that balance of projects to know that you're not overwhelming one group versus another.
Okay. And as we move into prioritizing, does the sizing, are you trying to get to a single number or some kind of single metric for sizing, or do you track along the way, you know, the how big of a project is this? What's the revenue picture kind of look like? What's the impact on the organization? Do you track those separately?
We track it all separately because, okay. You know, like so many companies, we both need to meet short-term financial goals, right? And we also need to move strategically in the direction that we're trying to move the business. So, mm-hmm. You know, you're looking at an initiative and you're not just doing the things that might produce very large opportunities for the future. You're doing some things that are going to produce some short-term results to meet the current quarter or current year's financials. So it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of making sure that the sizing, you know, the assumption might have been, well, you look at this catalog and based on the back of the envelope math, do the top five projects from a revenue or an expense save, you know, that are going to have the top five bottom line impacts. But it's not that simple because of the things we talked about before, the impact to the organization, the stakeholders. Those top five things might all be, you know, a year to 2 year in duration to produce those big numbers that got on the spreadsheet, mm-hmm. But we need to do a few things to produce some revenue this year. So what are some short-term projects we can do that are fairly easy to get done, involve less stakeholders, and it's a balance of those two.
And so when it comes to balancing those, that, I guess, brings us to your third element you told us, which is prioritizing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, probably through the discussion we've had up until now, we've really talked quite a bit about this. It's bringing all of that together. We've got the back of the envelope numbers. We're looking at the portfolio. I meet with my product team. And this is, again, another one of these non-scientific components. But we look at the projects and we say, you know, this one's strategic. It's going to take 2 years, but it's important. We need to put some resource on that. But now that I'm going to be doing something to tie up a resource and no impact for 2 years, you know, what can I do for this year? And those two projects have now tied up, you know, our technology, a good chunk of our technology budget. So what do we have that doesn't involve technology? And, you know, again, it's more art than science and determining, okay, this is the set of projects we're going to do over the next few months. And back to my example of the sales team, or once we've assigned those projects out, as the projects close and go live, that product manager then can take another project. So we not only prioritize the full list, or, you know, at least prioritize the ones that we think we want to get done in the next year, but we always make sure that we add an additional number of projects prioritized beyond that, because unforeseen circumstances might cause a project to shut down for whatever reason. You know, mm-hmm. We decide halfway through it, it's not going to work. So you want to know then in the priority order, what would have been the next one to take its place.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So I had two questions coming related to that, which was, first, when it comes to the portfolio, a lot of companies will approach the portfolio with specific buckets in place ahead of time. You know, for example, say, you know, there are our cash cow products today. They're going to get 30% of our effort to make sure those are staying competitive. That thing that might be really strategic, that is 2 or 3 years out, we're going to look for 20% of our investments in that area, right? And you come up with buckets for how you're going to use your money on new products. How do you guys do that related to prioritization?
We do mostly we prioritize along tactical and strategic. So we've got enough, you know, tactical short-term projects versus strategic transformational where we're headed as a business. Within that, we are not as focused on putting percentages against individual categories or buckets, but we do try to have a blend of revenue generating, expense saving, and client satisfaction improving. And those three, you know, I'd love to say they're all equally weighted. And that's where I said we don't focus the percentages, because back to that art versus science of using technology and what resources need to be involved in any given set of product mix, you know, it might be nicely 33%, 33%, 33%, or it might be, you know, 25, 10, and 45, if I'm doing my math right. But we try to keep it in those three categories, and within each category, balancing, you know, for revenue, expense, and client satisfaction, you know, kind of half that are tactical and half that are strategic.
Okay. And the tactical versus strategic is just a timeline for you.
That's right.
So
yeah,
the things that are nearer term. And is strategic more in the 1 to 2 year horizon?
Yeah, it's probably 1 to 2 year. It's probably just a little more than short term, long term. It is strategic. Is also about a direction we're heading in, the strategy of the company. And so there could be some things that are more short term, but are about moving the business in the direction, we're trying to change it to.
Right.
But by their nature, they tend to be longer term projects.
Yeah. And a lot of times when companies look at those specific strategic activities, they realize that there are some common tactical activities to do now, right, that work across some of the bigger picture things that you want to accomplish in the next year or two.
That's right.
Okay, so the other part of the prioritization I was going to ask you about then is, I have this picture of the big funnel in my mind, lots of ideas coming in, and our objective here is to select the ones that make the most sense. And you made the statement that you want to have some backups, right? So after you've actually done the selection, you're doing some projects, you want to have some backups because some things fall out. And in a traditional, stage gate perspective of how we are managing the actual development of the product, where we're doing work in some stages, and then we're going basically assessing the risk to going forward or not, we want to have the healthy mentality of saying, okay, this one really isn't going to be meeting our objectives. We're going to kick it out because it doesn't work for the company. And then, focus more energies on the other ones or bring a new one into this pipeline. I imagine that's the sort of thing you talk about, and I'm just curious what your process is for kicking things out then.
Yeah, so we do follow a loose stage gate process, and depending on the project, at the initial kickoff of the project, we determine where those stages are going to be and how many they're going to be. And, depending on the more complex the project, the bigger dollars associated with delivering it, you'll probably have more stages. So it's usually at least even the smaller projects have a couple of stages. The very first one is taking that back of the envelope number that got it to the point of in the priority scale being assigned to a product manager to work on, and then really vetting those numbers, doing a little more market research, making sure that the assumptions are valid. And then, right before launch, at a minimum, again, for the smaller projects that might only have two stages, you've worked on it, you're thinking about the rollout. If there's a limited build, that would be another opportunity to say, now, is this really the time to roll this out? Is there a better project that's come along? Have we learned more about it? If it's a much bigger project and it's got more stages and maybe there's a real build stage, it's not a tweak, but it's going to involve some significant technical investment, then once the requirements are written and we've met with technology and met with whatever other areas are going to have to make some significant investment and change, then there's another chance to say, based on now what we know, is it going to take longer? Is the return not going to be as great relative to some other project? And that, for the bigger projects, there's a few more stages. What's always a bit tricky, and you've probably seen or heard this before, is now you've invested a good amount of time, you've built your requirements document, you've got all the stakeholders involved, and you realize that maybe it's not going to be as profitable as you thought, but it's still going to produce, positive bottom line impact. Now, relative to another project, it's no longer the biggest one, and that might imply, the pure finance person would say, well, stop that project and do the other one. But you've invested all this time, and there's a value in everyone's head being into the project. And if you stop it and try to come back a year from now, will you lose some timing there? Or, as you work on that next project, what if when you get halfway through it and you learn a little more about it, a better project has come along? You could spend your time entirely in the process of stopping projects because something better has happened versus just completing them. And that's always a fun discussion when you get to that point of a stage and you're assessing the project and now comparing it and saying, is there something better? Is this the right thing for us to do? There are those on the side of the pure math says stop and move to the next thing. But, there are often others saying, we've gone this far, let's close it out. Unless you really learn it's unprofitable or, very marginally profitable.
Sure. Yeah, it becomes a complicated situation and you want to assess the strategic value, in that discussion too. People are naturally resistant to, well, as you said, we've already spent all this money. Let's not waste that, right?
Yep.
But the reality is, if we really do conclude that this isn't the best this project is not the best fit for the organization, given all the other things that we have opportunities in, then we should not be spending more money to, it's not like we're making better use of the money we've already spent. You know, that is the time that we need to cut our losses and focus where we need. The good thing about that is we've all learned a lot, right? So this process, and for anyone listening that's not familiar with that stage gate sort of idea, I'll include a link in the show notes to a resource for you. But whether we're doing, you know, lean startup kind of thinking or agile or stage gate or other processes we might think of, the idea is all the same, which is we're trying to take some action up front, just like Peter described, on let's make sure we understand the size of the market of this product, right? Let's make sure we understand what the real customer need. So we're basically testing some hypotheses and gaining knowledge before we start spending big money, which is usually the actual development of the product. And we're just managing our risk along the way.
And you can always return those projects that you then deem to go on hold. Doesn't mean they're dead forever.
Absolutely.
It means at this point in time, based on the opportunity and the available resources and other projects, you know, known to be more viable, you're just going in a slightly different direction, but there's a good chance that you'll come back to that at some point in the future. And back to our pipeline, our database, mm-hmm. We just change the status at that point, you know, put it on hold, make another project active. We'll always, you know, it'll be reassessed the next time we're looking for the next project up.
Right. And that's part of a good selection process too, which is if we have an idea that had merit, but it's just not the right time, right? Because we have to hit the market trends correctly and what we're trying to accomplish as an organization. There's a lot of ideas that end up coming back around that have great value later that just don't work now, right?
Right.
And so I then assume in your process here for selecting ideas, somehow those ideas that get tabled, you put them somehow back into a catalog to refer to them in the future.
Yeah. Back to my sales analogy, it's almost like it's the sale that, you know, you're not going to pursue, but it's still a target. It's still a prospect. It's mm-hmm. still out there. And so it's in the database. Nothing ever gets deleted from the database. Only its status changes. And if it doesn't change to closed, then it changes back to either on hold if we started it, you know, or it goes back to a waiting assignment to a product manager, depending on, you know, where it was when it got tabled.
So the prioritization element of this was wrapped up in how that is mapped to the portfolio and looking at what you did in the sizing to assess the overall potential revenue here, the work that needs to go in, how it impacts the organization. And so now we're ready to actually select ideas that are best for the organization, right?
Yep. Yeah, so this one actually is probably less complicated than it probably would imply, because if you've done all the, you know, you've done the prioritization process and you've gotten all the information down, it's a matter of just getting, what we like to do is have a team do it, right? You don't need me running the product team to be deciding all the projects. So you get a team of people that's looking at this set of data and all of these nuances between who would need to be involved, technology, operations, short-term, long-term, tactical, and looking at the three buckets that we talked about, revenue, expense save, or client satisfaction. And so we just have a team. So, okay, these are the ones we think we should do. And based on the available bandwidth of the product managers, who in my team, product managers, are basically project managers, and there's a slight difference. We have true project management discipline for the big, more complex projects. But if it's a tweak to a product, you know, that the product manager can do, may not have full project management experience. So the team gets together, we come up with the set. We also have to assign them to the person who's going to manage that project based on the skill set. Mm. So depending on what area of the company, we have subsets of products that we offer. And so we want somebody who's going to manage it that's a subject matter expert. So the team makes those decisions, and then that becomes our game plan for launching the products or the projects.
And so did I hear you correctly, that team is primarily made up of product and project managers?
That's right, because the product managers are the P&L owners, responsible for the bottom line and the revenue in our organization. And I know that is different in different companies. So because you're P&L focused, you're looking after not just the top line, the revenue, the expense, you know, you're also looking after the expense and the EBITDA. So they make that ultimate decision, taking the feedback from everyone, which came through the pipeline process, but that final selection is done in product management.
Okay, that's a good clarification. So there are people that have the P&L responsibility, because in some organizations, you know, this could even be the executive team. It could be a senior management team that does this. But the probably one common thread is people that are connected to the money and have a responsibility for meeting financial objectives are involved in making the selection decision.
Yeah. Now, the bigger the projects, to be fair, obviously, if we're going to commit to spending a good amount of money, we come up with that recommendation list, but we probably have to run them by the executive management team.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So in this sort of process, do pet projects ever pop up? And if so, how do you deal with that, right? And the way I define a pet project is someone who is advocating for a specific project for any kind of reason, right? Because it improves their political position inside the company, right? It gives them more influence. They just believe in their hearts it's the right, best thing to do. But there's another agenda going on in a pet project that can skew the analysis some. Do you face that? And if not, I guess you don't have any advice on it, but I want to know what you think about it.
Yeah, not a lot. I think because we have made a fairly scientific process around the collecting, the vetting of the ideas, the pipeline, the selection, in order to insert something into the process, you know, it's pretty hard to do because we have to answer to those questions around, you know, why would you have done this one if it only has a benefit of X when there were all these other projects with the benefit of Y? And we have a proven track record within my product team of actually delivering on the projects and getting pretty close to the numbers that we said we'd get. So we don't get a lot of pressure for people to put, I shouldn't say that. We sometimes get pressure, but we're pretty good at being able to use the math and the process and the system to weed them out.
Very good. Yeah. So you have a structure in place in the system that just works.
The system allows us to put a big stamp of no on it. And, yep. But there's a process behind it that helps us defend that.
Okay. And then you had a fifth element, which I was actually curious about, because the focus here is selecting the right idea. And we just got that done. So what is the fifth element?
Yeah, managing the projects themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So up until now, you've just got the project, but managing them, you know, so a mix of small and large, and what's the right number of projects for any one product or project manager to manage is also a bit of an art and science. And how do you report on it? And how do you get the right resources? I've got a fairly small product team, but we beg, borrow, and steal on projects from the whole organization. And that's not just from a, you know, resource standpoint, but it's always good to have representatives on the project team from those disciplines, from the stakeholders. But even beyond the stakeholders, again, we take and look for individuals in the organization who have a track record or an interest in wanting to be part of something bigger. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to have a massive product organization. You can actually use people and individuals who that's not their day job, like the idea of being part of a project team. So I always recommend to folks who say to me, you know, how do you deal with all these projects and you got a small team? I always say, don't let the team be the issue. There are plenty of smart people probably in your organization who'd be happy for a short term to either run a project or assist on a project. And that's all part of the management process. I also highly recommend that the documentation be fairly consistent. I'm not big on overly bureaucratic processes, but there should be some baseline templates to be used for when you're managing the project, mm-hmm. and that there be a project plan. It doesn't have to be in a project plan software. It can, again, be in Excel, but key milestones, deliverable dates. We talked about making sure you know for this project, how many stages am I going to have and where am I going to have them? And of your project materials, storing them in a place that if for some reason the project manager, you know, gets sick and isn't in, somebody else can pick up the project, mm-hmm. and know where it's at.
It's actually interesting that standardization provides more flexibility, because when people are accustomed to seeing the same information about projects, how we plan projects, how we're monitoring and controlling them, keeping track of what's going on, it's easier to move people around and be even more effective and have added flexibility.
Yeah, and you can learn quite a bit then from that process or from that project to then build it into the template for the next time. Mm-hmm. You know, things that went right, things that went wrong, you can share the idea is a lot better when you've got consistency. We always decide early on the level of status reporting. Not every project has to have a weekly status update. Again, it depends on the size of the project, scale of the project, but you need to make that decision up front of, you know, what level of meeting and what level of reporting are you going to have, and who is the executive sponsor or sponsors for that project, and how often do you need to update them. And then, of course, the rollout, which is, you know, really critical. You know, you can work on the project, but if you don't get the timing right on how are you going to go to market and who needs to be communicated to and how, and bring in the marketing team or the relationship management team if you're selling it through to your existing client base, and making sure that you've timed that right. So as the project is coming to a close, you've done all that prep work on the go-to-market. You've got the materials in place, whatever messaging you're going to put out there. And that's really all part of managing a project. But at the same time, you've got a portfolio of projects. So, you know, there's another level of management. And this one, you know, I'm not often working directly on the projects, although I sit in on them. But I'm often working at, it's almost the PMO equivalent, right? We've got product managers running these projects, but how do you manage the projects as a group? And, you know, I like to have a good reporting that shows what is the total value of the entire pipeline. Every one of those 150 ideas in the database, you know, is worth $20 million, we'll say. Your reporting should show that. And then how many of them are active? How many are actually assigned to product managers on the team? And that might be $7 million right now of active projects going on. And then how many are closed since you started keeping records, you know, projects that you finished, completed, rolled out, and they're producing $10 million. That's all part of the process, you know, I like to manage around the projects as a whole and getting that management reporting out to the organization so they see the value of product management. They can look quickly and get a sense of, this is how big the opportunity is of all the projects. These are the ones you're working on now. These are the ones you've closed. This is what you've contributed. And then I guess the last point I would just make on this topic of managing the projects is that feedback loop, right? When a project closes, we think it's really critical at the 6-month and the 12-month interval after the project is closed to go back and look at whether or not the results we were expecting that we vetted initially and put in the pipeline and caused it to be chosen, did it actually achieve them? And if so, great. If not, why? And what can we learn about the if not, so that the next time we're in the selection process, maybe there's something we've overlooked. What can we learn? What can we think about differently? So all of that is, you know, how you manage the projects as a whole.
That's a good closing of the loop to come back and assess what did we learn from the project that can improve our selecting ideas process and make that even better in the future. So I'm sure there are listeners that I find this framework really approachable and something that would be pretty straightforward to implement. I'm sure there's listeners that don't have an idea management system now in their organization are thinking, you know, this is something that we can get our hands around and actually do. There's some pitfalls I've seen, and I'm sure there's some you have seen too, that, things that people need to avoid. One I brought up early, which was you need to make sure that people are providing ideas, get feedback. So this sounds like a sequential process, right? So in this list of steps, where do you provide that feedback to the idea providers?
So the idea providers, we do it in a number of ways. So once they first submit it, of course, it's a thank you, got it, it's in the log. You know, if we vetted it, we let them know what we think it's worth. Next time we communicate with them is if the project gets accepted. But we tell them that if they don't hear back from us, it's not the fact that the project isn't going to be worked on at some point in time. It just means, given our prioritization process, it's not being picked up compared to all the other projects that are out there. So when we do pick it up and start working on it, or if we make a determination at some point that it just is not feasible, period, it can't be done legally, it's not allowed, it's not going to work in the market, you know, we'll let them know it's done. Mm-hmm. But we'll let them know when we pick it up and it's assigned to a project manager and becomes active. So that's usually the second time we give them feedback. We give them feedback when it's closed, because in the documentation, we always carry forward who submitted the idea. So as it closes, we let them know it closed. Congratulations, the project is live. And then after we do that, not the 6-month, but at the 12-month assessment, we'll go back to the submitter and just let them know, did it actually achieve the results we all thought? What were the final benefits of it? So, and it doesn't take a lot of work to do that. That's just, you know, the project manager or the product manager is working the project, just has to remember at those key milestones that just let the person who submitted know.
And to manage this process itself, do you have a dedicated process manager responsible for the elements we just talked through?
We do not. And I know that's, again, quite shocking because I think you can make a lot out of product management and you can put a lot of process into it. And there's a lot of technology, and probably for some companies that's necessary. But the team itself, an admin assistant helps us just keep track of it. But it's not even a full-time job for that person. So we keep it simple. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather have the resources working on the projects than working on the process.
Very good. Are there any other key pitfalls that come to mind for someone that would be thinking about trying to implement what we've talked about?
I don't think so. We started this process. I took over running the product management group about 4 years ago and put some of this discipline in place, but it really wasn't complicated. The biggest thing I would say to folks who are trying it for the first time is don't overcomplicate it. Start simple. You can always make your templates a little better over time as you learn things, but don't try to spend an inordinate amount of time trying to come up with the perfect template, the perfect process. Use something simple and over time build on it. Mm-hmm. And also making sure that there's good management reporting. I think, product management is probably one of those disciplines that's, not, I don't want to say it's well respected, but like appreciated in terms of how much it can drive in terms of bottom line impact. So having a reporting process that goes out to executive management on the projects will get folks the resources they need, but don't start out asking for a lot of resources. I was once asked, when somebody looked at my pipeline, if I gave you more resources, could you do it? And could you do more of the projects? And I said, I'd rather get a proven track record, see how many of these projects we can do with the existing team. Then we'll come back and ask. And it's always better to kind of prove yourself first, come back and ask for resources later.
Yep. Good advice. And one more question about this whole process. Do you provide any kind of incentives for people providing the ideas originally and, the ones that are selected?
Yeah, it's been a big source of debate. We don't because we don't want it to be that the reason you're submitting is to get money. We like to feel that everyone in the organization is part of the success of the organization and that they all bring some ideas to, make the product set better or the service we offer our clients and stakeholders better. So we don't. I mean, we do occasionally, we recognize people and, there's as much value out of just the internal recognition of submitting a report to executive management and thanking the four or five people who helped produce, what could be millions of dollars of bottom line or hundreds of thousands of dollars of bottom line. And, for many folks, that feel-good factor. And again, occasionally we do some periodic rewards after the fact for successful projects. But we don't want people feeling that the reason I'm submitting it is to get money. The reason they should be submitting it is, to help the company, which thereby helps them.
It is a topic that gets debated a lot, right? And you said yep. Your organization, others. My personal position, I think financial incentives for ideas that get submitted that actually do turn into helping the company some way. I think providing financial incentives to the submitters is evil. And the reason why it's evil is because it does too much harm to the overall culture of the organization.
I agree.
And you might be incentivizing a few key people, but what you want is a culture that itself is excited to see how can we deliver more value to our customers. And you start getting everyone thinking that way and you make the culture more effective.
Yeah, I'd much rather spend the money hosting a lunch for a team of individuals who've submitted ideas or hosting a lunch for a business group and asking them, what ideas do you have? Mm-hmm. Sort of spending the money that way. And, they get a free lunch, but they're also being asked ideas and to brainstorm together and, where are the pain points that you see our clients having? And let's talk about them and put them up on a board. That to me is a better use of the money than giving someone a financial reward for coming up with an idea.
Very good. And as listeners know, I like to always ask for an innovation quote. And what quote did you bring us and why did you choose that one?
So I brought one by Larry Ellison, the co-founder of Oracle. And the quote is, when you innovate, you've got to be prepared for people telling you that you are nuts. And, you know, in product management and, you know, innovation is part of what product managers do. We are constantly being told with these ideas, you can't do that. We've done that before. It didn't work. We looked at that before, but decided it didn't make sense. You know, legally, you can't do it, but I don't have a basis for telling you that. So a lot of naysayers out there who say you're crazy if you know, you're trying to get this stuff done. But we just take the lumps and move on.
Right. And there's something to be said. If no one is telling you that you can't do it, then it probably isn't really innovative.
Absolutely. That's a good one.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. It's been a pleasure talking to you. You've laid out some clear steps. For people that want to just follow up and connect with you, what's a good way to do that?
Yeah, probably best through my LinkedIn account. So it's Peter J. Duggan, and at ComputerShare, head of product management, product development. You'll find me out there, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has. And thank you, Chad, for having me.
Great. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for listening. The one thing I ask you to do is tell others about this podcast. It means so much to me when you do. Go to theeverydayinnovator.com/054 to find the show notes and details of the discussion. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.